The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from The Week magazine this week, dated October 26th, 2012. And as usual, we begin with the main story section of The Week magazine. Our first article is entitled, Obama and Romney's Tense Confrontation. President Barack Obama's re-election campaign regained some traction this past week after he showed renewed energy and confidence in a tense town hall-style debate with Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney. Circling each other like two angry lions, the candidates fiercely criticized one another on issues that included taxes, immigration, energy policy, gun control, and the consulate attack in Benghazi, Libya. Obama was on offense much of the night with a far more animated and assertive tone than in the first debate 2 weeks ago, when his disastrously disengaged performance helped give Romney a major bump in the opinion polls and put several battleground states back in play. Dismissing Romney's 5-point economic plan, Obama said it was actually a 1-point plan designed to make sure that folks at the top play by a different set of rules. Romney responded by listing the promises Obama made 4 years ago that he had failed to keep, including lowering unemployment to 5.4% and failing to cut the deficit in half. We can't afford 4 more years like the last 4 years, Romney said. A CBS News Knowledge Network's poll of undecided voters found that 37% gave the win to Obama and 30% to Mitt Romney, with 33% calling the debate a tie. The RealClearPolitics.com national election poll continued to find the race virtually tied. Now here's what the editorial said. Welcome back, Mr. President, said the New York Times. Instead of the windy and lethargic responses he gave in Denver 2 weeks ago, Obama regained full command of his vision and his legacy. He was crisp and persuasive when defending the accomplishments of his first term, and he forcefully fought back against Romney's parade of falsehoods and unworkable promises. Apparently, Obama does want to be reelected, after all, said Bloomberg.com. But while he won pretty decisively on points with a spirited performance that often left Romney sputtering defensively, Obama was at his weakest when making the case for why he deserves a second term. That's because Obama is a president without a plan, said the Wall Street Journal. He spoke generally about wanting to lower the deficit and improve education, but voters still don't know what he might seek to accomplish in the next 4 years. Instead, he reflexively went on the attack, hoping the argument that he's not as awful as Mitt Romney will be enough to eke out a victory. Now here's what the columnist said. The president won this round, but barely, said Stephen Stromberg in WashingtonPost.com. He did voters the courtesy of bringing his A-game, effectively poking holes in Romney's mathematically challenged tax plan, and scoring points on women's issues and his rescue of Detroit's auto industry. But he also had his fair share of vague and uninspiring moments. Romney, meanwhile, damaged himself by looking defensive and pushy, bickering over fine points with Obama, and repeatedly arguing over procedure with moderator Cindy Crowley. The exchange over the Benghazi assault was Romney's low point, said Daniel Larrison in the AmericanConservative.com. By wrongly insisting that Obama didn't initially use the words act of terror to describe the assault, Romney turned what is clearly a political liability for the administration into an advantage for his opponent, giving Obama an opening to lecture him on politicizing a foreign policy crisis. Romney was right on substance, if not on details, said said John Podhoretz in the New York Post. The White House did take 2 weeks to admit the attack was an Al-Qaeda planned terrorist attack and not a spontaneous mob reaction. But by getting tangled up in semantics, Romney let Obama off the hook. The president's base will be energized by his return to form, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com, but that won't bring the race back to where it was before the first debate. That face-off established Romney as a competent and worthy alternative to an incumbent who no longer inspires hope. It's possible this race is no longer about Barack Obama, said Peter Beinart in the DailyBeast.com. The polls may have swung so dramatically after the first debate because many voters were ready to vote against the president, so long as Romney passed a reasonable threshold. If that's true, this campaign may now be Romney's to lose. The next article from the main story section for this week is Preparing for Cyber War. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta said the U.S. was at risk of a cyber Pearl Harbor and cited recent attacks widely attributed to Iran as signs of pre-9/11 moment. A cyber attack this summer on the Saudi state oil company, which left more than 30,000 computers disabled and displaying an image of a burning American flag, was probably the most devastating to ever hit the private sector, he said. While Panetta did not explicitly name Iran as the culprit, other U.S. officials did. They said that Iran created a military cyber corps after the 2010 Stuxnet cyber attack on its nuclear enrichment efforts, and that Russia and China also have impressive cyber war capabilities. Panetta warned that enemies of the U.S. could now basically take down a power grid, take down a water system, take down a transportation system, take down a financial system. So why haven't we done anything about it, asked Gary Hart in HuffingtonPost.com. So far, there's no law requiring the private owners of critical U.S. infrastructure to meet basic cybersecurity standards. The proposed Cybersecurity Act would have forced them to, but it died in the Senate this summer because Republicans said it imposed too many burdens on business. President Obama should simply issue an executive order, said Bloomberg.com in an editorial. And while he's at it, he should make clear that the U.S. is prepared to preempt attacks and to respond with overwhelming force. The U.S. has already shown its readiness, said Peter Beaumont in The Guardian. Stuxnet, which sent Iranian centrifuges spinning wildly, was widely reported to be a joint effort by the U.S. and Israel. Analysts think that the same crack team wrote Flame, a massive and complex cyberworm that inflicted huge data losses on Iran this year. The Pentagon is calling for more cyber contractors and says it is getting an overwhelming response from industry and academia. This is a manufactured excuse to waste billions of dollars, said Douglas Birch in Foreign Policy. The apocalypse won't come even if the electric grid is taken down. Just look at how easily India handled the biggest blackout in world history earlier this year. The U.S. should keep the degree of risk in perspective. We know what happens when it doesn't, said John Dvorak in PCMagazine.com. Does anyone remember Y2K? Our next item from the main story section is the EU's Nobel Peace Prize. The European Union was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize last week for its efforts to prevent military conflict in Europe since the end of World War II. The EU has helped to transform most of Europe from a continent of war to a continent of peace, said the committee's chair, Thornbjørn Jagland. He also warned of an increase of extremism and nationalistic attitudes as the 27-state union is racked by financial turmoil, and expressed hope that the prize would remind the EU of its fundamental aims. The Norwegian Nobel Committee's choice came as a surprise to many, as social and political pressures within the 17-member Eurozone risk breaking the EU apart. This was a well-deserved award, said Simon Nixon in the Wall Street Journal. The EU has promoted democracy and good governance across the continent for 60 years. It has helped Spain and Greece overcome fascist rule and created a bulwark of stability for Eastern European countries freed from the burden of Soviet occupation. Its single market has paved the way for a huge expansion in trade, binding Europe together and guaranteeing an end to conflict. Tell that to the immigrants threatened by Europe's resurgent fascist parties, said Andrew Roberts in Bloomberg.com, or to the Greek shopkeeper forced to board up his shop for weeks at a time because of riots. What fabulous ignorance to reward the European Union for keeping the peace, just as its autocratic anti-capitalistic system looks set to collapse into mayhem. That timing is no accident, said Michael Moynihan in the DailyBeast.com. The EU was rewarded for not deeds it has done, but for future expected ones, like bailing out Greece, Spain, and Italy. The Nobel Committee has tried to shape global policy before, of course, rewarding President Obama in 2009 for setting a new tone in U.S. foreign affairs. And yet today, wars continue and drones fall. It's a humbling reminder that this yearly exercise in moral preening has little impact on the real world. Our next item from the main story section is the controversy of the week, and this week it's entitled Romney's Tax Plan. Do the numbers add up? Mitt Romney has a math problem, said the New York Times in an editorial. Every time he outlines his proposal to cut all federal income tax rates by 20%, some pest with a calculator will point out that it doesn't add up. Romney has said he'll eliminate the unspecified loopholes and deductions to make his tax cuts revenue neutral, even though a 20% tax cut for everyone, along with elimination of the alternative minimum tax and the estate tax, would cost the government about $500 billion a year. But just last week, the nonpartisan Joint Committee on Taxation concluded that even if Romney eliminated almost every tax deduction on the books, including those for charitable contributions and mortgage interest, he could only cut tax rates by 4% without adding to the deficit. When asked about his plan's numbers during this week's presidential debate, Romney could only say, "Of course they add up." Sorry, but every objective analysis of his numbers says they don't add up, said Josh Barrow in Bloomberg.com. So why propose a 20% tax cut in the first place? With his conservative credentials under fire in the Republican primaries, Romney obviously plucked that number out of thin air for political reasons without regard to whether it was feasible. Actually, the plan is feasible, said John McCormick in WeeklyStandard.com. The left-leaning studies that challenge its numbers are deeply flawed. These studies fail to take into account the increased revenue that will come from repealing Obamacare, and they assume that pro-growth tax policy can't actually produce economic growth. It can and does. Here's how the math works, said the Wall Street Journal. By eliminating loopholes and capping an individual taxpayer's deductions at 17%, Romney would cover about $3.8 trillion of the $5 trillion in tax cuts, would cover over 10 years. The other $1 trillion or so would be provided by the increased tax revenues that would come from the economic growth stimulated by a more efficient tax code and lower marginal tax rates. What's so mysterious about that? The mystery is the continued faith that tax rates lead to a boom in economic growth, said former Reagan advisor Bruce Bartlett in NYTimes.com. An analysis of tax policy over the last half century, including the 1986 Reagan tax cuts that lowered top rates from 50% to 28%, shows that such cuts do slightly stimulate the economy, but only by tenths of a percent, and the impact doesn't last. Romney's contention that tax reform would jumpstart our economy is nonsense. Even my fellow conservatives ought to admit the truth here, said Ryan Salam in NationalReview.com. It's highly unlikely that a Romney administration would cut the top marginal tax rate as deeply as it has proposed. To keep his rate cut from expanding the deficit, every credible study shows Romney would have to eliminate so many deductions that many middle-class taxpayers would have a net increase in taxes paid. That would be political suicide. But President Obama's math is so no less fuzzy. His proposed tax increase on the wealthy could not possibly pay for his immense spending commitments. What neither candidate is willing to admit is that something big has to give. We can't keep cutting taxes and protecting entitlements, benefits, and services from major spending cuts. Either voters accept a transformative change in Medicare, Social Security, and other benefits in coming years, or taxes will have to go up on nearly everyone. Now, from the main story section, we will turn to the very popular section here called Good Week 4 and a Bad Week 4. It was a good week for second chances after pro quarterback Michael Vick, convicted in 2007 of running a brutal dogfighting ring, said he'd gotten a dog. As a father, Vick said, it is important to make sure my children develop a healthy relationship with animals. It was a good week for wearing your patriotism. After conservative radio host Glenn Beck launched a clothing line designed to pay tribute to the nation's founders, patriots can buy a pair of premium ring-spun selvedge denim jeans for $129 and Western-style shirts for $90. And it was a good week for shotgun weddings after a jeweler in Iowa started offering free guns to customers who buy an engagement ring. Diamonds are a girl's best friend, said store owner Harold Van Beek. So say, I'm hunting deer, and here's a diamond ring, dear. Okay. It was a bad week for Rolling Stones fans after the band announced several 50th anniversary concerts in London and New Jersey with top tickets priced at $680 and the cheapest seats going for $170. These prices are a joke, said fan Steve Grace. It was a bad week for following the original intent of the law. After Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia's car was issued a $31 parking ticket in Philadelphia, despite a police official business placard on the dashboard. We don't recognize placards, a parking official said. And it was a bad week for double meanings after a Georgia Chick-fil-A franchise passed out flyers that said only a fruitcake wouldn't love our party trays. The company, which has campaigned against gay marriage, said it had no intention of offending anyone whatsoever. Now we'll turn to the briefing section from the Week magazine for this week, October 26, 2012. The world's silliest territorial dispute. Why are China and Japan threatening to go to war over a few uninhabited islands in the East China Sea? Are the islands important? Only in a symbolic way, the eight tiny islands and outcroppings known as the Senkaku Islands in Japan, which administers them, as the Daoa in China, and as the Chiaoyutai in Taiwan, have a total area of less than 3 square miles and are home only to a band of feral goats. Located about 100 miles northeast of Taiwan and 265 miles west of the Japanese islands of Okinawa, they do sit in prime fishing territory, and there are natural gas deposits and possibly large oil reserves nearby. But it is national pride honed by centuries of bitter rivalry and war between Japan and China that provides the prime motivation for the contesting ownership claims. As a growing world power, China is eager to assert its authority over Asian waters, while Japan doesn't want to be seen as yielding an inch. We must draw the line with the Chinese here, said Hisho Yanai, head of a Japanese nationalist group. If we let them have the Senkaku Islands, they'll come after all of Okinawa next. To whom did they first belong? China says it has records from the Ming Dynasty in the 1300s that refer to the islands as part of the maritime territory. Chinese fishermen used the islands as a fishing platform for centuries, the government claims, before they were ceded to Japan, along with Taiwan in 1895, in the wake of the Sino-Japanese War. After World War II, a defeated Japan renounced its claim to Taiwan under the terms of the 1951 Treaty of San Francisco. China, which was not represented in those negotiations, says the disputed islands should have been included in that renunciation. For its part, Japan says that after surveying the islands in 1895, it incorporated them into Okinawa Prefecture and put down a marker to make it official. For several decades, the Japanese operated a small factory on one of the islands, making dried fish flakes, and up to 200 people lived there. The U.S. held the islands under a trusteeship after World War II, but in 1972 they were returned to Japan. Why has this flared up now? Well, largely because of Shintaro Ishihara, the nationalist governor of Tokyo. Early this year, he announced that he would buy three of the islands from their private Japanese owner because he felt their sovereignty wasn't being adequately defended. That compelled first Chinese nationalists and then Japanese nationalists to make pilgrimages to the rocks to film themselves waving their respective flags, stirring up patriotic sentiment back home. Last month, the Japanese government bought the three islands and nationalized them, ostensibly to prevent them from falling into the hands of radicals. But even assuming that rationale was sincere, the timing was especially poor, coming just a week before the anniversary of one of the darkest episodes in the two countries' history, Japan's 1931 invasion of Manchuria. How did China react? Chinese nationalists viewed the purchase as an outrageous land grab and a deliberate provocation. They turned the events marking the anniversary of the invasion into a week of anti-Japanese rioting across China. Japanese-owned shops were smashed up, Japanese factories were burned, and Japanese citizens in China were harassed. More than 40 Japanese cars were destroyed, and a mob in Xi'an beat up a Chinese man for driving a Toyota. Damage from the riots is likely to cost hundreds of millions of dollars, and trade between the two countries has suffered. To make its continued claim clear, the Chinese military sent naval ships to the islands for training exercises 3 weeks after Japan nationalized them. Could war break out? Chinese media have warned that it might. Politics is fanning the flames with a once-a-decade leadership transition coming up. China's Communist Party wants to project strength and national pride, while the Japanese opposition is exploiting the crisis to paint Japan's unpopular government as weak on national sovereignty. Still, it's unlikely that China would actually invade the Senkaku, not least because the U.S. could get dragged in under terms of its defense treaty with Japan. It's probably no coincidence that the U.S. recently deployed some of its most advanced aircraft to Okinawa, not far from the islands. So will it all blow over? Maybe for now, but the issue won't go away permanently. The dispute is one element in a Japanese-Chinese power struggle over a string of archipelagos from the Kuril Islands near Russia down to Indonesia. Nearly all of Japanese and Chinese oil and gas is shipped through those waters. June Teufel Dreyer, a China and Japan specialist at the University of Miami, says the Chinese military considers the Senkaku Islands to be part of a chain fencing China in. They say if we get these islands, we can break out into the open Pacific. China won't give up that dream. The footnote to this briefing section about these islands that are contested between Japan and China is entitled A Long History of Conflict and War. As East Asia's two major powers, Japan and China, have been at each other's throats for centuries, the Beijing-based Mongol emperor Kublai Khan tried and failed to invade Japan in the 13th century. For centuries thereafter, marauding Japanese pirates harassed the Chinese coast, and the two countries fought a bloody and extended war over control of the Korean Peninsula in the late 16th century, and another in 1895, which Japan won. In the 1930s, the rise of Imperial Japan brought the two nations into direct conflict again, this time with unprecedented brutality. Japanese troops marched into Manchuria in 1931 and then into Beijing, Shanghai, and Nanking in 1937, raping and slaughtering civilians. China claims that 35 million people died during the Japanese occupation, and at least 300,000 civilians lost their lives to atrocities committed in Nanking alone. Those horrific events, which some Japanese politicians and school textbooks have periodically downplayed, have haunted Sino-Japanese relations ever since. And you're listening to our reading of the Week magazine for the week of October 26, 2012, here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks so much for joining me today. Now we will turn to the best columns of the U.S. according to the Week magazine for this past week. The first one is called The Case for Leaving Afghanistan, and it was an editorial in the New York Times. After more than a decade of having American blood spilled in Afghanistan, said the New York Times, it is time to get out. About 68,000 troops are still fighting there, and the Obama administration wants to keep a substantial force until the end of 2014. But to what end? It's now clear that no military victory over the Taliban is possible. Meanwhile, Afghans we are supposedly training, are killing our own soldiers, and nation-building in the corrupt, fragmented country is failing. How can we continue to ask young men and women to risk coming home horribly maimed or dead for a war we cannot win? After the U.S. leaves, the Taliban will undoubtedly take over parts of the country, and Afghanistan will remain a backward and fractured land, ruled by warlords and religious extremists. But that will also be true if we wait two more years. As for Al-Qaeda, it already has outposts in other nations, and counterterrorism efforts do not require massive land forces. Americans want out of this pointless stalemate, and so do our soldiers. Prolonging the war will only do more harm. The next column is entitled, Why Spend Billions on Highways? By Walter Russell Mead in the Wall Street Journal. Advocates of big government and Keynesian stimulus have a continuing love affair with infrastructure, said Walter Russell Mead. They're always arguing that the federal government should spend tens of billions on highways, bridges, tunnels, and the Holy Grail itself, a national high-speed rail network. But while we need to maintain and improve roads and bridges, conventional infrastructure is not where we should be directing most of our precious federal dollars. First of all, there's no longer any such thing as a shovel-ready building project that creates immediate jobs. Construction is inevitably delayed by local and state approvals, NIMBY lawsuits, and fears we'll hurt spotted owls. More importantly, the ongoing internet revolution is dramatically reducing the need to physically move people to offices, stores, and social events. Instead, the government should focus its efforts on creating a true information age economy with an expanded information superhighway and policies that reward companies for promoting telecommuting and teleconferencing. In the 21st century, building new roads and railroads makes as much sense as developing a new and improved national canal network. And the next column is entitled The GOP's White Man Problem by Renee Loth in the Boston Globe. If demographics are destiny, the Republican Party is facing a serious quandary of electoral math, said Renee Loth. Nearly 87% of its registered voters are white, and this may be the last national election in which the GOP can get away with directing its message primarily to this one group of voters. As Senator Lindsey Graham, the Republican from South Carolina, recently observed, we're not generating enough angry white guys to stay in business for the long term. In recent years, nearly all of the nation's population growth has come from minorities. This year, a record 24 million Hispanics will be eligible to vote. And by a 62-25% margin, they favor the Democratic Party. The GOP has two choices. It can stick with its harsh policies on immigration, poverty programs, and other racial wedge issues, and hope to suppress minority voting through voter ID laws. Or it can broaden the party appeal and stop alienating African Americans, Hispanics, gays, and single women. If the GOP relies solely on the grievances of a diminishing faction of white men, it will soon become irrelevant. And now we'll flip to the back of the magazine. For this week, the last word is entitled Spring Break in Libya. College student Chris Gion hungered for real experience, says Joshua Davis, so he joined a revolution. His plane touched down in Cairo on August 23, 2011. School didn't start again for another month, and Chris Gion, a 21-year-old UCLA math major, had told his parents he was going sightseeing in Egypt. What he didn't tell them was that he had decided to fight with the Libyan rebels against Muammar al-Qaddafi. He wanted to see something historic, he told friends. His $9,000 a month internship at BlackRock, one of the world's largest asset management firms, bored him. After 12 to 18-hour days in his cubicle, Gion felt like he was dying. He packed one pair of jeans, three shirts, a leather jacket, a pair of Converse, and two condoms. He hopped a bus in Cairo and headed for Salom on the Egyptian-Libyan border. The rebels guarding the border were playing the FIFA soccer on a PlayStation when he arrived. Gion waved at them. They glanced at his passport and went back to their video game. Okay, cool, Gion said, and simply walked into Libya. It looked like the moon, empty, burnt brown desert, stretching for mile after mile. The front lines were 500 miles to the west, and Gion, the son of a successful Korean immigrant, didn't speak Arabic and hadn't done much research on the region. He'd read the Wikipedia page on Libya and watched a bunch of YouTube videos documenting the war. He particularly liked the one that showed a group of rebels chanting in unison after a victory. He'd never felt that fired up about anything. A year before, in search of real experience, he and a friend had spent spring break surviving on the streets of Seattle with $1 in their pockets. Gion did another dollar trip to Las Vegas. For Gion, living outside the bubble of UCLA was a revelation. In early September, he finally managed to get a ride to an oil refinery close to the front lines. Pickup trucks, mounted with rocket launchers, streamed out of the complex, heading west. Tripoli had fallen, but Qaddafi was still at large and unbowed. On the radio that day, he vowed to fight a long, drawn-out war. Qaddafi's loyalists had concentrated their firepower in the central coastal region near his hometown of Sirte, the city the rebels were heading for. As they rolled out of the refinery, each truck blasted a different song. Tupac bled into high-pitched Arabic music, followed by the Scorpions. The men on board wore green camo with red checkered keffiyehs over their faces. One of the trucks stopped, and a young rebel stuck his head out of the window. "Jackie Chan!" he shouted at Gion and swung the back door open. Holy you-know-what, this is really happening, Gian thought, as he squeezed in among the men, the RPGs and the AK-47s. Nobody asked who he was or why he was there. They just handed him a grenade, some earplugs, and a cigarette. 20 minutes later, they stopped on the side of the road where a clump of pickups stood in the open desert. Suddenly, a shell landed nearby and sent a huge plume of dirt into the air. The rebels in Gion's car leaped out of the cab, returning fire with a 50-caliber machine gun mounted on the bed of their truck. Others fired cannons and launched rockets. There was no coordination. Everybody just let loose with every weapon they had, aiming in the general direction of the incoming fire. Shells rained down around them. The rebels panicked, scrambling to get into their vehicles. As they sped away, one of the rebels put his hand on Gion's chest and felt his heart thudding heavily. Everybody glanced at Gion and laughed. He looked terrified. "Where you stay?" the rebel asked. "Nowhere," Gion replied. "No problem," he said. "You stay with us tonight." 2 days later, Commander Absalom gave Gion an Arabic name, Ahmed, and the next day a rebel gave him a Russian shotgun. The kid was no longer an observer. He was becoming part of the Katiba, the Libyan word for brigade. He still didn't speak much Arabic, but that didn't seem to matter. There was a cheap Casio keyboard in the town house where they stayed, and when they weren't on patrol, Gion taught a skinny 17-year-old named Akram how to play Beethoven. Akram showed him how to assemble and break down an AK-47. After 2 days, the Casio was covered in gun grease, but Akram could play Fur Elise and Gion could feel strip the gun in less than 90 seconds. Akram explained that Libya under Gaddafi was hell. A few months earlier, his cousin had spoken out against the dictator and had been executed. "I am fighting for my cousin, for my family, and for my country." Akram said, "I have no fear because death would be better than living the old way." A couple of days later, the Katiba drove into the desert and fired cannons at loyalist positions. Gion helped load the ammunition. "My lips were cracked and bleeding. I hadn't brushed my teeth in days, and my face was peeling. But it didn't matter," Gion says. "I was totally happy, happier than I'd ever been." He was standing beside a truck, watching his friends fire the cannons, when he heard the whine of an incoming shell. Everybody dove for cover, and the ground shook. Sand rained down, and somebody screamed. When he finally stood, he saw a mangled, charred body lying near the blast. It was Akram. He stared at the body. Just a few nights before, Akram had played Fur Elise, jumping up and down when he did it without a mistake. He was only 17. That afternoon, at a rebel checkpoint in the desert, Gion saw three trucks appear out of the heat shimmering off the road to the west. They were moving fast, inbound from Gaddafi-held territory. The rebels around him picked up their weapons, cigarettes dangling from their mouths. As the trucks approached, Gion saw someone lean out of one of the windows with a gun. It seemed surreal, like a mirage in the desert heat. The rebels around him started yelling, and he heard bullets whiz past. They were under attack. Gion said, grabbing used an expletive here, "mother blank." Gion hissed, grabbing an AK-47 out of the bed of a truck. He knew how to assemble and disassemble the gun, but had yet to fire it in battle. Now he could see the faces of the loyalist forces as they drove off the road, circling the rebels and strafing the checkpoint. He flipped the safety off. A bullet pierced the leg of a man next to him. The screaming was buried underneath the report of automatic weapons. Gion was breathing fast. He popped up from behind his vehicle, took aim, and fired at one of the circling trucks. The gun jerked wildly, and he ran out of bullets. He loaded another clip. This time, when he squeezed the trigger, he saw the passenger's head snap back. Blood spattered the inside of the car. After another volley, the attackers sped back to the west, and it was quiet again, except for the growls of the wounded. One of the rebels walked up to Gion and slapped him on the back. You are a Libyan now, the man said. Christian decided to return to California the day after his first battle, a changed young man. He was scheduled for a full load of classes in the fall semester of his senior year, linear algebra, differential equations, game theory. But by November, he'd lost interest in math and almost everything else he used to care about. He slept during the day and stayed up late so that he could talk to his Libyan friends on Skype. By spring break, he decided to go back, and I went with him. The sun is setting in Benghazi when we touched down in April. That night, we walked to Freedom Square, where the revolution started. The buildings around the square are lined with oversized photos of rebels who died in the war, which ended just 5 months ago. A group of men approach and ask where we are from. When Gion introduces himself, they throw their arms up, shout, and embrace him. They had heard the stories of the Asian kid from L.A. who had fought on their behalf. He is famous here, Mohammed al-Zamwan tells me, explaining that rebel fighters had spread Gion's story. Al-Zamwan, a 28-year-old youth organizer, gets choked up the more he talks about it. I don't have words to describe how I feel about what he did. He was fighting very bravely for us. He is amazing. The next night, Gion reunites with five of his rebel friends at a second-floor hookah cafe on the outskirts of Benghazi. We thought American people didn't care about Libya, says Ebrahim Benamer, a 23-year-old rebel with a soul patch. But after we met Ahmed, we realized we were wrong. When the hookahs are smoked through, Gion gets antsy. He's heard there's an informal drifting competition on the square, and he wants to check it out. When we arrive, four cars whip past us, skidding sideways. Benamer wants to give it a try in his pickup truck, which is still emblazoned with the spray-painted logo of his brigade. He honks his way through the crowd, stomps on the accelerator, and starts fishtailing across the square. When he comes to a stop near us, Gion, dressed in a goofy T-shirt, yanks open the back door and leaps in. I follow him. Benamer peels away before I even shut the door. As I struggle to close it, I notice his AK-47 rattling on the floor. It looks like it's loaded. Libya Drift 2012, Gion shouts. He's filming himself with a pocket camera. Benamer spins the wheel, forcing the car into a long semi-control skid, and then accelerates. We spin sideways at about 40 miles an hour, heeling up on two wheels before the truck crashes on its side. In seconds, Gion is standing on the overturned pickup, screaming, "Libya is great!" 10 minutes later, the car is surrounded by men with machine guns. They are accusing us of being with the CIA. But my translator is sure they just want to rob us. These are very bad people, he says. They are going to take us into the desert and we'll not come back. I can see some crumbled buildings 50 yards away. Maybe we can make a run for it. I look over at Gion and see him smiling. Dude, are you scared? He asks, laughing. You look scared. Another truck of armed militiamen pulls up, and the new arrivals begin arguing with our captors. We are driven to a militia compound where the argument continues for hours. Finally, near dawn, we are released with no explanation. Back at the hotel, Gion is ecstatic. We all are. I am still worried that a militia might track us down at the hotel, but I also feel the rush of being free. It's 6 a.m. and I'm not tired at all. In fact, I feel enormously alive. You see what I'm saying about Libya? Gion asked me. It's amazing. He says he craves the instability. It's the total opposite of what I was doing before, he says. It forces him to take nothing for granted, to live in the moment. I can see the logic, but I still want to get the hell out of here. I book a ticket to Istanbul, departing the next night. As I'm checking out, I see Gion in the lobby. He's heard about some fishermen nearby who throw explosives into the water and then scoop up the fish that float to the surface. I'm going to give it a try, he says brightly. I just have to find someone who will sell me some dynamite. And that article was copyrighted 2012 by the Men's Journal, first published in Men's Journal and distributed by the Tribune Media Services, Inc. Now, from the Week magazine, we'll turn to the Health and Science section for this week. Our first article is entitled, A Depression Breakthrough. A hallucinatory party drug could point the way to the first new treatments for depression in a generation. Scientists have discovered that ketamine, Special K as it's called, which clubgoers take for dreamlike highs, also improves mood disorders by repairing damaged connections in the brain. What's more, ketamine works within hours as opposed to weeks, even for people whose mood disorders have proved resistant to other drugs. The breakthrough represents maybe one of the biggest findings in the field over the last 50 years, Yale University neurobiologist Ram Duman tells NPR.org. Researchers involved in the study say the previous model of depression based on the idea of chemical imbalances in the brain may be wrong, and that depression may be the result of stress-induced damage to brain cells that control mood. Ketamine, they say, speeds the growth of new synapses, the connections between brain cells, and can quickly reverse the neuronal damage associated with depression. The most popular class of depression drugs, SSRIs, don't work for about a third of those struggling with depression. Ketamine's negative side effects, including hallucinations, delirium, and kidney damage, make its widespread use as a depression treatment unlikely. But what the drug is revealing about how the brain works, Duman says, may lead to new, safer drugs and ultimately provide a much better way of treating depression. The next item is entitled, Why Free Contraception Matters. Free access to birth control could prevent up to two-thirds of U.S. abortions, a new study has found. Nearly half of all pregnancies in the U.S. are unplanned, and of those, more than 40% end in abortion. But when researchers at the Washington University School of Medicine offered more than 9,000 mostly low-income women and teens free birth control, the number of accidental pregnancies in the group fell to between 60 and 80% below the national average, LiveScience.com reports. Receiving free contraception made teens, a group at particularly high risk for unintended pregnancy, one-sixth as likely to give birth. The impact of providing no-cost birth control was far greater than we expected, says study author Jeff Peipert. The women in the study were more likely than average to choose long-lasting forms of birth control like IUDs and hormonal implants, which have a high upfront cost but are more dependable. Making such contraception methods available to women who can't afford them, Peipert says, is the key to reducing both unintended pregnancies and abortions. And the health scare of the week from the Health and Science section of the week, fish, mercury, and pregnancy. Pregnant women may be getting overly simplistic advice about avoiding fish. Experts generally recommend that expectant mothers consume no more than 2 servings of fish per week because the high mercury content in many species can damage a baby's developing brain. But a new study suggests that pregnant women who eat more than 2 servings of fish per week are half as likely to have a child who later shows symptoms of ADHD, such as hyperactivity and difficulty concentrating. The omega-3 fatty acids in fish appear to offer dramatic protection against these behaviors, which affect as many as 1 in 10 American children. Boston University environmental health professor Sharon Sagiv tells WebMD.com the same study, however, also reinforced mercury fears by showing that pregnant women with above-average mercury levels are up to 70% more likely to have a child with ADHD symptoms. The results are not necessarily contradictory, says Harvard Medical School professor Susan Korick. Rather, they emphasize the importance of eating fish that's less apt to contain mercury, such as tilapia, haddock, and salmon, instead of larger species that tend to host high levels of it, such as tuna and swordfish. Now we'll turn to the Talking Points section of the Week magazine for this week. Our first article is entitled, Race, the Stealth Issue of the Campaign? And there's a question mark at the end there. Stacey Dash obviously did not read the black memo, said Crystal Wright in WashingtonPost.com. Dash, an actress of black and Mexican descent who won middling fame for her role in 1995's Clueless, recently tweeted her support for Mitt Romney for president. Her nine-word endorsement, accompanied by a pin-up photo, uncorked racist rage from Obama supporters, who alerted Dash to the unspoken rule that all blacks must vote for Democrats. On Twitter, African Americans called her a traitor and a house nigger, mocking her hair, her heritage, and her intelligence. The insults all boil down to one message, said Jesse Washington in the Associated Press. A black woman would have to be stupid, subservient, or both to choose a white Republican over the first black president. Ugly rhetoric aside, there are good reasons why so few blacks support Romney, said Cheryl Ifill in CNN.com. The GOP's assault on Obama from day one has been fueled by outrage that such an interloper could occupy the highest office in the land. He has been dismissed as lazy and stupid and called the welfare president and the food stamp president. A congressman interrupted a presidential address by shouting, "You lie." Millions of Republican birthers still insist against all evidence that Obama was born in Kenya and is thus an illegitimate president. For blacks, all this represents an assault on our collective racial dignity. The appeals to bigotry are not even coded, said David Sirota in Salon.com. A few weeks ago, conservative activists dredged up a 2007 Obama speech on Hurricane Katrina to a mostly black audience and criticized the president for supposed calls to racial solidarity while using a phony black accent. Race still matters, and it would be ridiculous to pretend it doesn't, said Orson Aguilar in the Sacramento Bee. Polls indicate that 94% of African Americans will vote for Obama, while about 60% of whites will vote for Romney. Why such a wide gulf? And what about the wealth gap between the races? For every dollar of white family wealth, the median Asian family has about 63 cents, the Latino family has 7 cents, and the black family has less than a nickel. Americans deserve to hear both candidates address the obvious racial and ethnic divisions in our society and what they plan to do about them. Please, gentlemen, play the race card, but for once do it honestly and without fear. The next article is Biden versus Ryan, a generational smackdown. Now you know what Thanksgiving with my family is like, said Maureen Dowd in the New York Times. Last week's debate between Vice President Joe Biden and Republican candidate Paul Ryan was an Irish Catholic Donnybrook, with Biden playing the role of the bombastic older uncle who denounces every political opinion except their own as malarkey. The vice president amped to make up for all of Obama's missed shots in the first presidential debate, forcefully exposed the gaping holes in the Republican ticket's tax platform plans, and nailed Ryan for twice soliciting the very stimulus money he condemns. Biden, 69, treated the 42-year-old Ryan with patronizing disdain, said Alan Schroeder in CNN.com, smirking whenever Ryan spoke and interrupting him 82 times. At times, it looked as if Ryan was afraid Biden might ground him and take away the car keys. That doesn't mean Biden won, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. He managed only to further muddle a muddled narrative on what really happened in Benghazi last month and dismissed Iran's defiant progress toward a nuclear bomb, insisting against all evidence that sanctions weren't working or were working. Biden's bigger failings were his preening exhibitionism and smirking rudeness and egotistical exuberance and bullying condescension. His Democratic apologists say it's just Joe being Joe, but Americans have every right to hate politics if it looks like this. What a pity that Ryan failed to stand up to the bullying, said Brett Stevens in the Wall Street Journal. He gulped visibly when under attack and was too deferential. Even when Ryan fought back, such as in defense of Romney's remarks in the 47% video, he resorted to canned lines. And now for some short items as we reach the end of the program today. This year's winner of the $5 million in Mo Ibrahim Prize for Good Governance in Africa is nobody. The prize rewards a democratically elected leader in Africa found to have raised living standards and to have voluntarily left office. No candidate met the criteria to win the prize for the third year out of the last four. Politicians in Missouri usually alternate between pronouncing the state's name as Missouri and Missouri. The Missouri pronunciation, favored in the southern part of the state and by older conservative residents, is often used when candidates speak to rural audiences. And Social Security checks, with about 1.5% higher, they will be about 1.5% higher in 2013, one of the lowest cost of living adjustments in the program's history. Consumer prices nudged up slightly in 2012, so the average retiree who gets $1,237 a month will see an increase of just about $18. The poll watch for this week, for the first time, a majority of Americans, 52%, say the U.S. government should stay neutral on values issues. 44% say the government should promote traditional values. And just 22% of Americans say they are in the 47% who do not pay federal income taxes. Most people do not differentiate between income taxes and payroll taxes. We have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We certainly hope that you have enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time.